vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CQUT 90.3 FM. We are 17 days into the month of March. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special edition of CQUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, we have two episodes of the Talking Radical Radio podcast, plus some information on our upcoming funding drive. All that right here on CQUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news@cqut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @avalancqut.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. CKUT's funding drive is coming up. From March 18th to 28th, CKUT is collecting donations for our annual funding drive. This year's theme is Sowing the Seeds of Grassroots Change. If you want to support independent grassroots media, this is your chance to do so. As a thank you to our listeners who pledge, we offer gifts as incentives. We have custom printed CKUT t-shirts, bags, and toques. Some of the funding drive tiers include one entry to the grand prize draw at $30, one 2021 t-shirt and entry to the grand prize draw at $60, and a 2021 t-shirt, bag, and toque, plus two entries into the grand prize draw at $120. If you wanted to pledge this year, you can do so by phone at 514-448-4013 to donate over phone, or you can check out ckut.ca/donate to donate online. If you wanted to send in a check, you can do so by mailing Radio CKUT at 3647 Rue University in Montreal, Quebec, postal code H382B3. Remember, when you make your pledge, be sure to mention The Avalanche as your show of choice. Up next is an episode of Talking Radical Radio with Scott Nye. This episode is titled The Past and Present of Medical Colonialism in Canada. That's up now.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio. Hello, and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are facing many different struggles, talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening is a crucial step in strengthening all of our efforts to change the world. On this week's show, I'll be speaking with Samir Shaheen Hussein. It's often not appreciated by the beneficiaries of colonialism, meaning among many other people around the world, white settler Canadians, how all-encompassing and world-shaping the colonial process has been. Practically every aspect of our social world has been, at one point or another, swept into active complicity in colonization, and in that process, been profoundly shaped by colonization. This is true not only of state institutions, but pretty much everything else, too. And because of this profound and unresolved legacy shaping how our world works today, colonial harms and active complicity in them continue all around us. The show this week is specifically about medical colonialism, that is, the role that the medical establishment has played in genocide and colonization in Canada. Samir Shaheen Hussein is a pediatric emergency physician who practices in Montreal and an assistant professor in the Faculty of Medicine at McGill University. He first started really thinking about medical colonialism because of his involvement in a campaign against one very specific aspect of it. For decades, it was the practice of the Quebec government agency Évacuation Aéromédicale du Québec to prevent caregivers from accompanying sick and injured children on emergency medical evacuation flights from northern and remote areas to urban hospitals. This was highly traumatic for both caregivers and children, medically unwise, and not consistent with best practices in pediatric emergency medicine. It had the most severe impacts on Indigenous communities in the northern part of the province, not only because of the great physical distances involved, but because of the context of long colonial histories of a whole range of government authorities taking children from those communities. There had been a number of attempts over three decades by communities and medical practitioners to get this practice changed. It was only through the A Hand to Hold campaign, in which Shaheen Hussein played a central role, that the practice was ultimately ended in 2018. And he'll talk about that campaign a bit in this interview, but to hear about it in more detail, go to talkingradical.ca and search for the episode of the show featuring Shaheen Hussein from February 2019. After witnessing gross expressions of anti-Indigenous racism from prominent Quebec politicians in the course of the campaign, as well as ongoing denial of the existence of systemic racism, Shaheen Hussein decided to use this experience as the basis for writing a book. Fighting for a Hand to Hold, Confronting Medical Colonialism Against Indigenous Children in Canada, was published in 2020 by McGill Queen's University Press. The book includes a foreword by Cindy Blackstock, a Gitxsan woman and renowned advocate for Indigenous children, and an afterword by well-known Mohawk activist Ellen Gabriel. The book begins from an account of the A Hand to Hold campaign and its victory against one aspect of present-day medical colonialism. It uses that as a jumping-off point to take up much larger questions. A key point made throughout the book is that, quote, healthcare inequalities follow the fault lines of societal injustices, end quote. So the book explores different ways of thinking about health that recognize how powerfully it is shaped by unjust social relations like capitalism, colonialism, and systemic racism. It also examines systemic problems within the culture of medical professions, and the core of the book takes up the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide and uses it as a framework to offer a very clear and accessible exploration of the history of medical colonialism in Canada, including how it has contributed to aspects of colonization that meet every element of the original definition of genocide. The book concludes with a discussion of what kinds of change we need to deal with the ongoing realities of medical colonialism in the present, both broader social changes like the return of land to indigenous nations and space for their full self-determination, and specific changes within the medical system. I speak with Shaheen Hussain about the A Hand to Hold campaign, about the bigger picture of both past and present medical colonialism in Canada, and about his new book, Fighting for a Hand to Hold, Confronting Medical Colonialism Against Indigenous Children in Canada.
My name is Samir Shaheen Hussain. I'm a pediatric emergency physician. I'm an assistant professor in the Faculty of Medicine at McGill University. I wrote Fighting for a Hand to Hold, Confronting Medical Colonialism Against Indigenous Children in Canada. The motivation for the book was to look at the A Hand to Hold campaign that I was involved with along with others in 2018 and use that as a case study, basically, to talk about overarching issues tied to systemic racism in healthcare and medical colonialism in Canada more broadly as well. I come from a family that's socially aware. I've been engaged over the years, so that's the climate I grew up in. But I would say I got more politicized or radicalized in medical school, actually, through various events. And that's when I started organizing. One of the first groups I organized with was the Indigenous People Solidarity Movement. Along with others, I was one of the founding members. And initially, we were based out of McGill University, and then we went off campus, and our focus was doing Indigenous solidarity work from a clearly anti-colonial, anti-capitalist perspective. And over the years after that, I've also been involved in anti-police brutality organizing and migrant justice work. And actually only more recently, despite the fact that I'm a pediatric emergency physician, have I been more actively and consistently involved in health justice work.
Before we talk about the book and the broader issues of medical colonialism that it raises, lay out the basics of the A Hand to Hold campaign that you were so involved in.
The campaign came about in January of 2018 in response to a long-standing practice or rule that was in place in the province of Quebec that prevented parents or caregivers from accompanying their children during emergency medevac airlift from rural and distant communities from urban areas. That was actually a practice that impacted all kids throughout Quebec who required medical emergency medevac airlift. But what our experience was at the Montreal Children's Hospital is that Indigenous kids, particularly Ewe or Cree and Inuit from Nunavik in northern Quebec, were disproportionately impacted by this practice. There are many factors that explain why they're disproportionately impacted, and I won't go into that. And this rule or this practice had been in place since the 1980s when this government agency called EVAC, Évacuation Aéromédicale du Québec, came into existence. And for the last probably around 10 or 15 years prior to the end of the practice in 2018, the service where this rule was implemented systematically was on their Challenger plane or their flying hospital. So meaning the kids who were the sickest were the ones who could not have a hand to hold during medical airlift. And so that's what the campaign sought to end. And the campaign, like I mentioned, was launched in January. And in late June, there was a formal announcement that was made issuing a new policy that would allow parent or caregiver accompaniment. That took a few months before it was implemented, but it was basically implemented as of October of 2018. And since then, it's very, very rare that a kid is going to be sent alone. So in that sense, it was a significant victory and one that many Indigenous communities, as well as other communities as well, had been calling for decades, in fact.
And again, I would encourage folks to go to talkingradical.ca and search for our interview from February 2019 for more details on the tactics the campaign used to win this victory and various other questions and issues surrounding it. And Samir, in the aftermath of this successful campaign, why did you decide to write a book about it?
I had absolutely no intention whatsoever of working on a book when the campaign was happening. There are two key elements that pushed me to ultimately write the book. The first is in June of 2018, Médecins Québécois pour les Régimes Publics, which is basically the Quebec cousin, I guess, of Canadian Doctors for Medicare, they came out in support of the campaign. And that caused quite a bit of a stir in June. And it seems that there was a member of the public who was following the story. And this person saw Gaétan Barrette, who was the provincial health minister, at a community event. This is in the context of provincial elections happening or about to happen. And so this person approached the health minister and asked why this was an ongoing issue. And Barrette's response, one of the things he said was that he could guarantee that in the next 6 months, there would be at least one person who would be refused from accompanying their kids because of being drugged or under the influence or agitated. And he said that this happens all the time. He didn't know that this person was actually recording him. Then that recording was leaked to the media, and it made headlines across the province and even across the country. Indigenous leaders, activists, politicians called for Barrette's resignation. That didn't happen. So the government in power stood by him. There wasn't really that much of a strong echo in the opposition party, or definitely not strong enough. And even in the public, there was clearly indignation, but there wasn't enough of an outcry to actually push him to resign. I found that was very jarring, that this person can make anti-Indigenous racist comments with such impunity. And so that was one thing that was getting to me. And the other element was in October of 2018, the current government of the Coalition Avenir du Québec came into power. They won the election. And the leader of the government, François Legault, even when he was in opposition, basically led almost like a crusade against the concept of systemic racism. He denied its very existence. And even to this very day, he refused to acknowledge the existence of systemic racism. And so here I was involved with this campaign where throughout various points of the campaign, it was very obvious that there were elements clearly that reeked of systemic racism. And this politician, the head of the government now, was denying its very existence. And so I thought it'd be compelling to use the Hand to Hold campaign to expose not only that systemic racism and medical colonialism are very concrete elements of Canadian history, but that they are ongoing to this day.
And that idea of medical colonialism is an important part of the analysis that you lay out in the book. In general terms, what is medical colonialism?
Medical colonialism is a concept that has existed in the literature based on so many other people's work on this issue. I tried to frame it in a way that could be useful moving forward. Basically, thinking of medical colonialism as a culture or ideology that's rooted in systemic anti-Indigenous racism that uses medical practices and policies to establish, maintain, and or advance a genocidal colonial project. And I use genocidal very intentionally. Most of the manuscript was written in the summer of 2019. And you'll recall that in June of 2019 was when the report for the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls came out. And that one of the conclusions for that report was that a genocide has occurred in Canada. And there was massive backlash at the time. And it's actually that compelled me to frame the entire section, which is basically half of the book, on medical colonialism according to the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. And so all of the chapters in that section are divided according to each of the five acts in the UN Convention that basically constitute genocide. And within each of those chapters, then, I give examples that were widely practiced and had impact on many children. And I focus on Indigenous children specifically. And so when I'm talking about medical colonialism, it's really talking about it in the context of the medical establishment playing a role in genocide as part of the colonial project here in Canada.
Walk listeners through some of the key historical examples of medical colonialism in Canada.
If we look at the five acts in the context of the convention, if we start with the first act, the act of killing members of the group. And one of the examples I give there, among others, is the intentional spread of smallpox out west in what is now known as British Columbia, that decimated the Indigenous population, many different Indigenous nations at the time, you know, mid-1800s. And what I try to focus on is the role of physicians and the medical establishment throughout. In this particular case, there was a physician who was basically the architect of spreading this. And a lot of my work in this section is based on the work by Tom Swanky, who's done enormous research on this very issue over the last 10 years. But I try to parse out from his work, looking specifically at what the medical actors did. And there are all kinds of other things too, you know, like at this time, there was actually a vaccine that was given for smallpox. Children in what is now known as British Columbia were supposed to get this vaccine. But when it came to Indigenous communities and Indigenous children specifically, this vaccine was withheld from them. And that obviously resulted in significant death. So that's just one example, talking about killing members of the group. If we move on to the second act, we're talking about deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And the example I give here, I draw on the work of Ian Mosby, a historian who wrote a landmark paper a few years ago, and it looked at nutrition research and human biomedical experimentation in Indigenous communities and residential schools in the mid-1900s. And one of the examples I focus on is how Indigenous kids in residential schools were forced in a state of malnutrition and starvation. And medical practitioners, doctors, researchers, scientists, nutritionists took advantage of that state to see what effect implementing supplements was going to have on their health. This is just monstrous. It's barbaric. It's cruel. It's criminal. And it's one of the reasons why I clearly consider it genocidal. But again, what many people don't know is that physicians were leading these kinds of initiatives with impunity. The third act is causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Here as well, I give several different examples, but one of them is the example of the Indian hospitals. The Indian hospitals played such a huge role in healthcare in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And they came about because healthcare in Canada was essentially an apartheid system. Indigenous people seeking healthcare at mainstream hospitals or settler hospitals were often not allowed to even enter the doors. And so there was this network of Indian hospitals that was created across Canada. And one of its mandates was treating people with TB. Medical historian Maureen Lutz has done a lot of work on this. In many cases, kids were sent to these hospitals for treatment for TB. There were forms of abuse. Kids were not allowed to speak their language. They were punished for doing so, or practice their culture, practice their spirituality. There was cases of sexual abuse. So this is a big deal in terms of, you know, a place that's supposed to be a place for healing was in fact a place of violence. And then Act 4 is imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. And here, one of the sources I rely on heavily is Karen Stote, who published a few years ago a book which looked at the forced sterilizations of Indigenous women and girls. Sterilization acts that were passed in BC and Alberta in the early 20th century had disproportionate impacts on Indigenous women and girls. And then the last act, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. And this comes back to the forced transfer of Inuit from Nunavik and Nunavut in the 40s, 50s, and 60s for tuberculosis treatment. This is something that was mandated by the federal government with, at the helm, Dr. Percy Moore, who was a physician himself. There was a ship that would go into the various Inuit communities. Inuit people were forced to board, and everyone went through a series of evaluations and tests. And if people were found to have tuberculosis, they were retained on the ship. In some cases, they weren't even allowed to go back to their homes to get their things. They were just detained there, effectively, on the ships. Sometimes kids were detained without their parents, breastfeeding mothers. In some cases, when they were detained, their babies would be taken from them and given to some other family member or another member of the community to take off the ship. And this practice continued for years, and these people would then be shipped down to southern hospitals. And in many cases, they didn't come home because either they died. In the case of children, some of them were adopted or put into foster care. And so this historical example provided a link to the A Hand to Hold campaign in a way, and there's actually a bridge between the Inuit mass evacuation and the Medevac non-accompaniment rule, which is that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, a journalist, Anne Panasuk of Radio-Canada, brought to light how Indigenous children had been medevaced by plane alone for healthcare and were literally disappeared into the healthcare system, into the medical system. This happened in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And this was not only Inuit. We're talking about the Atikamekw Nation, we're talking about Innu, and we're talking about Anishinaabe as well, among others. And so you can understand that in light of this history, even with the best of intentions in 2017, when, you know, a kid from Nunavik or from Uishi, James Bay Cree territory, needed to be transferred for emergency medical care by plane and their parent was not allowed to come with them, there's a huge, longstanding history of medical violence that had been inflicted on these communities for decades, causing multi-generational trauma. And to have neglected that in the medical provision of care is what I argue is an example of medical colonialism.
What does medical colonialism look like in 2021?
So some of these things, unfortunately, are still with us. You know, forced and coerced sterilization of indigenous women and girls. There are cases that came up only a few years ago, and now there's a large class action lawsuit on this issue across the country with cases from most provinces. And there are some cases that are as recent as 2018. So this is not old news. And I'm just giving a few examples, but this is obviously much more widespread. We can go back and look at barely 10 years ago, the case of Brian Sinclair, who was an indigenous man who had medical issues, had an indwelling urinary catheter, was in a wheelchair, and wasn't feeling well, went to a family physician. The family physician sent him to the emergency department. She had given him a letter to go with, which he had. He went to the emergency department, this is in Winnipeg, and was basically put in the waiting room. And the healthcare personnel thought that he was drunk or sleeping it off. And he waited 34 hours until they realized that he was dead. Clearly, that was informed by racism that's rooted in the history of medical colonialism. A few years ago, Kimberly Goad, a Mi'kmaq woman, was living in Montreal. She wasn't feeling well. She went to the emergency department. She didn't happen to have her Medicare card with her. And so they told her at the emergency department that she would have to pay $1,400 up front to access medical care. She obviously did not have that money. Most people don't. And so she went home, and she died 6 weeks later at home. Again, these cases happen all the time. The most recent example that I would give is that of Joyce Echaquan, which made headlines a few months ago. She died in Joliette Hospital moments after she live-streamed the treatment that she was receiving at the hands of healthcare personnel, where they launched racist epithets at her. She did this live stream to get her family, to get her out of the hospital. And instead, she died moments later, and that made headlines across the country, if not across the world. But these are the examples that just keep coming up over and over again. These are kind of tip of the iceberg examples because they're the ones that make it to the media. But if you ask Indigenous people across all of different kinds of communities across the country, everyone seems to have an experience either directly or through a family member of having been treated holistically at the hands of the healthcare system. And so it's clearly an ongoing issue.
In the face of the persistence of medical colonialism, what kinds of resistance are happening in communities and within healthcare contexts?
In the healthcare context, there have been a lot of Indigenous people who have been pushing these issues for years, and now finally it seems like they're getting some space to be able to implement the demands that they've been making for ages. There's this whole idea of decolonizing healthcare. When I talk about this in the book, I suggest that, you know, a decolonizing approach means that Indigenous people are self-determining with respect to their health and healing systems, including to what extent they engage with the dominant medical paradigm. And I think that's important because the dominant medical paradigm is rooted in a colonial history, in colonial science. And in order for things to change meaningfully in healthcare, that paradigm, those of us who work in that system, have to be proactive and aggressive, I would say, in pushing back against many colonial practices, but also seeking to learn to understand how to incorporate or work with healing systems out of Indigenous knowledge and culture. One of the other points I'd highlight in the book is that so much of the health inequalities, the health injustices we see are a result of what can be defined as the structural determinants of health. So the structural drivers that inform our society. Some of those that I mention in the book include colonialism, include systemic racism, include capitalism. And until we recognize that reality and the effect of those policies and legislation that exists in Canada as a settler colonial nation state, things are not going to change. That's why I intentionally try to highlight the importance of supporting Indigenous resurgence movements, land back movements, land defense. Because ultimately, the ideal scenario is obviously for Indigenous communities to have and to be able to fully enjoy and actualize autonomy and self-determination and then decide to what extent they want to engage with Western medicine.
What kinds of concrete things would you like to see more medical practitioners and medical educators doing to oppose medical colonialism in the coming years?
One of them definitely is listening. Understanding what Indigenous communities have been and are saying for years, if not decades, in fact. That's pivotal. The other element is having an emphasis in medical education and continuing medical education on the reality of medical colonialism. When I've been doing speaking events in the medical world, in the healthcare world, I'm kind of flabbergasted to realize how many people don't know about so many of these issues who are working in healthcare. That history is not taught. But that history is incredibly important because whether we're talking about, you know, what happened to Brian Sinclair, what happened to Kimberly Goa, to Joyce Eshakwan, why the non-accompaniment rule that the Hand to Hold campaign put an end to, why that persisted for so long, all of these things happen because there's a medical culture that allowed them and allows them to happen. And so part of confronting that medical culture means for us to understand when we come into a room and we see an Indigenous patient or family or child, that we realize the baggage that we are coming in with, because it's actually that's an issue in terms of impacting on effective, dignified, just healthcare. And unless we come to terms with our own history as medical practitioners, as nurses, as healthcare providers, that relationship that's inherently rooted in this colonial power dynamic is going to be very difficult to restructure. And so that has to change. That has to be implemented across the board in medical education from early on. This should be part of the curriculum just as much as anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, pathology is in medical school, for example.
What are your personal plans in terms of continuing to live your commitments to social justice and to anti-colonial practice in medical contexts?
For now, a lot of the work is actually tied to this. I've been pleasantly surprised, I guess, at the reception that the book has received. There have been a lot of interest in the healthcare field itself. So I think that's hopeful in a certain sense that there is finally this change that's come about. And that, I should mention, and I want to make that clear, obviously has come about because of longstanding years, decades of Indigenous-led self-determination movement. I make that very clear even when I'm talking about the campaign. You know, if this campaign would have been led exactly the same way 15 years ago, the results would not have been the same, because I feel that the political terrain has shifted over the last 15 or 20 years, if not 30 years, to the point where, you know, having Indigenous children being sent alone for medical care now is just unfathomable. Whereas I feel like 15 years ago, that was still probably considered acceptable. And the only reason that changed is if we go back even to 1990s, you know, like the Oka crisis or the siege of Kansasage, and all the resistance that's happened since then has really played a significant role in a massive political terrain shift. And so I guess my role in the next few months, at the very least, maybe years, I see as acting in solidarity with work that Indigenous communities have been doing for years and basically trying to push back against the medical establishment and create space or create more space so that Indigenous-led initiatives for health justice can thrive in the weeks, months, and years to come. I think one of the last things I would leave it at is the line that I use a few times in the book, which is basically inequalities in healthcare follow the fault lines of societal injustices. And I hope one of the takeaway points from the book for people is going to be that unless we confront and put an end to those societal injustices, inequalities in healthcare will persist. If we want that to end, then we really have to push hard to make sure that we put an end to societal injustices more broadly.
You have been listening to my interview with Dr. Samir Shaheen Hussain. To learn more about his new book, Fighting for a Hand to Hold, Confronting Medical Colonialism Against Indigenous Children in Canada, search for it on the website of McGill Queen's University Press. To find out more about Talking Radical Radio, the guests, the theme music, and the ways that you can listen, go to talkingradical.ca and click on the link for the radio show. On the site, you can sign up for email updates or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, SoundCloud, and other platforms. I'm Scott Nye, a writer and media producer based in Hamilton, Ontario, and the author of two books of Canadian history told through the stories of activists published by Fernwood Publishing. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you tune in again next week.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. Do you know CKUT's funding drive is coming up? CKUT is powered by listeners like you. CKUT receives no corporate funding, which is great because it means that the station is not controlled or influenced by commercial interests in any way. Station revenue comes from membership fees or annual funding drive and from advertising we do for local and grassroots initiatives. The funding drive is the perfect opportunity to support diverse, independent programming at CKUT. If you wanted to make a donation, you can do so by phone at 514-448-8 4013, online at ckut.ca/donate, Or you can also mail a check to Radio CKUT at 3647 Rue University in Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. There are tons of incentives for donating this year. To check out a full list of prizes, check out www.ckut.ca/donate. Remember, when making your donation, be sure to include Avalanche as your show of choice. Up next is an episode of Talking Radical Radio with Scott Nye. This episode is titled Students Mobilizing for the Decriminalization of Drugs. That's up now.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio. Hello and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are facing many different struggles, talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening is a crucial step in strengthening all of our efforts to change the world. On this week's show, I'll be speaking with Mary Kelly and Alex Bestas. It's a bit of a simplification, but you can break public policy approaches related to drugs into two broad categories. One of those approaches recognizes that to the extent that there needs to be public policy intervention related to drug use, it's in a way that focuses on health, supporting measures that reduce the harms that people experience, providing supports and services related to addictions to people who want them, and not just services that take an abstinence approach, and enacting the kinds of broader agenda that would enable people to live healthy, just lives in healthy, just communities. The other approach puts drug use in the realm of the criminal legal system. It responds to drugs, or at least the subset of drugs that elites have decided to target, with policing and imprisonment. Critics have pointed out that this quote-unquote drug war approach is ineffective in its ostensible goal of reducing the use of the drugs that it criminalizes, but it is very effective at causing harm, most directly to drug users themselves, but also to broader communities of people who don't necessarily use drugs, but who are already targeted by policing, namely people who are Black, Indigenous, otherwise racialized, homeless, sex workers, and/or gender nonconforming. In Canada, since at least the 1990s, there has been increasing deployment of rhetoric and, in certain respects, policy that centers a health approach, often in response to organizing by drug users and their allies. However, as important as some of those measures have been for keeping people safe, the bedrock of the Canadian state's orientation to drugs remains criminalization. Canadian Students for a Sensible Drug Policy, or CSSDP, is a grassroots advocacy organization that's been working on these issues since 2007. They bring together students and youth concerned about the harmful impacts of existing drug policies, and they advocate for evidence-based policy that centers health and harm reduction. The organization has around 18 local chapters, most of which are located on a university campus, and some of which encompass an entire city. It has a national board that supports the work of the chapters, does fundraising and outreach, organizes an annual conference, is working on a podcast, and engages in policy advocacy at the national and international levels. And currently, the national board also manages a funded project related to harm reduction-based education for youth about cannabis. Much of the CSSDP's advocacy work happens in collaboration with allied organizations. Since the start of the pandemic, a lot of their energy has gone into things like supporting calls to defund the police and local campaigns against punitive regulations related to cannabis use on university campuses, which in many cases are still in place despite legalization. Over the years, probably the most consistent theme in CSSDP's advocacy has been decriminalization, moving away from state responses that criminalize, particularly for simple possession and use, and towards a focus on health, not only in rhetoric and in specific areas of policy, but throughout the public policy realm and across levels of government in Canada. Mary Kelly is an undergraduate student at the University of British Columbia, and she's a national board member of CSSDP. Alex Bestas works at a health research center focused on substance use, and they're the international liaison for CSSDP. While both strongly agree with the importance of decriminalization, they also have their own individual thoughts about priorities for change in drug policy in Canada. Kelly, for instance, is quite involved in frontline harm reduction work, and she feels that getting police out of anything to do with that work is crucial. And she also wants advocates to do more to listen to and center Indigenous knowledge and practices. And Bestos believes that it's vital that we recognize not only the harms that current Canadian drug policies do to people in this country, but that we see those policies as part of, quote, an international regime of violence, end quote. They continued, quote, there are so many people in the global south who are negatively impacted by our drug laws and the drug laws that we enforce on them, end quote. I speak with Kelly and Bestos about drug-related public policy in Canada and about the work of Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy to make it better.
My name's Mary. I'm based out in Vancouver. I'm on the board for Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy. I do a lot of work in my community with harm reduction and health equity too. And I've been doing that for maybe over like a year or so. I'm from New Zealand originally, and I think coming from there, there's a huge lack of drug education and just talk about drug use and knowledge in that sense. And I think I moved here and was sort of like, I don't want to say enlightened, but there was so much more to explore and to learn. And I became very invested in helping and using my privilege to be able to provide resources and harm reduction for people in the downtown east side. I've always wanted to like let people know they deserve to take up space. And that passion led me to joining CSSDP and other organizations within Vancouver and Canada to help promote better policies for drug use. I think just my own experience and seeing how it's failed people back home and how it's failing people here, it just sort of pushed me, I guess, to become very involved on a community level.
My name's Alex. I'm the international representative for Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy. I've been involved with CSSDP since 2012 when I went to Simon Fraser University. And yeah, I've been doing harm reduction work in Vancouver, as well as drug policy stuff and now drug research for the past several years. The way that I got involved, it's kind of a funny story. I like to refer to it as I started out as a problematic psychedelic bro. When I was in high school, I was really interested in 1960s counterculture. I used to like go and sit at the Toronto Reference Library reading through like old books by various authors that were famous at the time. And I started going to raves when I was living in Toronto and in high school, which was the area where I first got to experience harm reduction and also be around lots of folks using drugs and seeing how communities can take care of each other. I got to university. I already wanted to join CSSDP. I was trying to find a CSSDP chapter, and there happened to be one at SFU campus. So I got involved through there. And then I joined the national board, I believe in 2014. And it's kind of shifted over time from at first being this kind of, man, why are these psychedelics illegal? Like they're trying to control our minds, kind of high school thinking, to seeing drug law as this form of international, but also national systemic violence that causes a lot of harm and creates a lot of justifications for harm towards various different groups of people. So Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy is a grassroots organization. It's primarily a chapter-based organization out of universities. So CSSDP has, I believe it's 17 chapters right now, and they're all based out of either like a city or off of a university campus. And the goal of the organization is to bring sensible drug policy and sensible drug reform issues to light, both from the perspective of youth as well as from students, with the goal of ultimately reforming our bad drug laws.
So what are those bad drug laws? What is Canada's current approach to drug policy and what's wrong with it?
The current Canadian drug policy approach is this contradictory understanding of substances and what they are. It mixes both like a punitive and a public health approach, simultaneously trying to deal with drugs and the fact that people take them. It's weird to think of, but Canada's come a long way in the last 40 years. And it now feels like Canada's a pretty progressive country relative to other countries when it comes to drug policy. Like you look at the United States and you're like, well, like, you know, at least we're not locking up such a huge percentage of our population. But Canada's historically had very punitive drug policy. And this mentality that people who use drugs deserve to be in prison kind of runs through the current of how we think about drugs and how we talk about drugs within Canadian society. That's the main problem, I would say, with the current Canadian approach. On the one hand, it recognizes that problematic substance use or substance use disorder is a health issue, while simultaneously having laws in place which treat it like it's a criminal issue. what CSSDP tries to do is point out these inconsistencies and how they actually need to be changed and how they harm specific groups, particularly Indigenous people, people of color, and in other ways, how they can harm women as well as LGBTQ people.
Yeah, in theory, they address drug use as this health issue, but then they execute it like a criminal issue. The culture around how we treat people who use drugs and the environment and the factors that go into drug use, it's all a very individualistic level. The way I've heard people address drug use is always like, oh, it's a health issue. But then when it comes down to it, they have no issue blaming the use on the person itself and not the wider society and the factors that play into that. So it's a very hypocritical approach to this issue. I guess they think if we treat it like a criminal thing, it's not going to exist. And they refuse to acknowledge that drug use is going to exist regardless of whatever policies and laws we have in place. They just don't want to change that because people benefit from these punitive policies, and keeping these in place would allow for a lot more, I guess, social control. And it's just an easy way to deal with what people view as surplus communities, unfortunately.
Canada talks a big talk. We have our health ministers telling us that drug use is a public health issue, or it's a health issue, it's not a criminal issue. And at the same time, we have penalties that include incarceration for people who use drugs. And this isn't a new phenomena. You can look back at House of Commons debates, even in the 1990s when Canada was enacting its current drug law, the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, where you have the deputy health minister, I believe, talking about how drug use is a health issue. It's not a criminal issue. And the opposition is arguing, saying, well, if it's a health issue, not a criminal issue, why do we have penalties that are associated with the act of possession of drugs? There's a contradiction in language, but I think ultimately the government has just decided that it ultimately is a criminal issue. And, you know, maybe it's partially a health issue, but I think if your main priority is incarceration, then I don't know how you could possibly say that it's a health issue, not a criminal issue.
What are the origins of the CSSDP?
CSSDP is the sister organization, we could say, of another student drug movement based out of the United States called Students for Sensible Drug Policy, SSDP. In 2007, SSDP and some of their funders were looking to create a Canadian version of SSDP. And so they met up with Tara Lyons, who eventually became the executive director, I believe, of CSSDP, or is one of the co-founders. And there's a cute, funny story of them driving across the country, you know, going to various university campuses, trying to set up CSSDP chapters. And then they had their first conference, and slowly over time, they kind of became their own independent organization.
What are some of the organization's core activities, say, starting on the national level?
On a national level, we focus with different committees, which focus on different areas within drug policy and harm reduction. We do things from different campaigns regarding bills, naloxone campaigns too, and we do a lot of toolkits too, and like education for youth. Underneath CSSDP, we have like a funded campaign and educational toolkit called Get Sensible, in which the point is to focus on educating and providing resources about cannabis knowledge for youth, from youth. We also do activity, like we're currently working on a podcast, which is really great, exciting stuff. I guess a lot of activities that focus on spreading knowledge to students and youth around such punitive drug policies that are happening in Canada and on a local level too, you know, things that we see in different provinces.
The National Board, its goals are primarily to help support the local chapters, but also work and collaborate on national campaigns, things that like individual chapters might not have the capacity to do, as well as try and connect youth and students that use drugs and students that are against prohibition with the larger international community of youth and students that use drugs, as well as partnering with various other Canadian drug policy organizations to work on projects that they're coordinating. So we work quite a bit with the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition, for one. Other people that we work with, the Canadian HIV Legal AIDS Network, CDPE, and I guess the goal is for the National Board to help like advocate on a national level for student and youth inclusion within those conversations, as well as creating campaigns of our own. And if we went from the national level down to the grassroots, most people on the board have either been part of a chapter or used to be like their chapter lead. The chapters have relative autonomy in terms of whatever projects they want to do. So during the pandemic, a lot of them have really like stepped up and done a lot of work around talking about like defunding the police, changing punitive cannabis laws on university campuses, which you would think after legalization would not be a thing that needs to be worked on, but you'd be surprised. As well as doing other projects such as working with their university to try and set up drug checking services, not just for students, but also for the broader community so that folks can get their drugs tested, particularly in a time where we have such a volatile drug supply.
I'm in the Vancouver UBC chapter, and we do a lot of panels too. We try to get in speakers from all areas in this field. Like we just did one about policing, we did some about cannabis and the roles that police go into drug use and enforcement around that. We want to be able to connect on like a local level to educate students and what's happening in that community. And UBC, the Vancouver chapter, there were a few mentions of trying to change campus policies around cannabis use. That's a very ongoing thing, though. It's difficult to approach topics like that.
How does CSSDP connect with students and youth around these issues?
There's a lot of campaigns that we do to inform like a select demographic or area, things such as like the podcast project and other campaigns that are really great to just, target people who aren't part of CSSDP and to introduce them into this world and into this knowledge of drug policy that they may not have had before. And I think Get Sensible, the project under CSSDP, that's a really great one too that we've been doing to inform people who aren't aware about cannabis use and knowledge and tools with that.
Our chapters do a lot of work relatively autonomously. We have a lot of trust and support in our chapters in terms of doing that kind of direct outreach to get people involved. I'm mostly stuck now because we're in the pandemic, and the pandemic has really shifted the way that you can do organizing or that outreach. I remember when I was a chapter leader, and we would do things like we had a 420 bake sale. This is before cannabis was legal. So this was back in like 2012, 2013. Where we had a little table set up where we were giving out baked goods to people and then moved outside to do like a 420. I don't even smoke weed, but I love the idea of this campaign at the very least. Go outside and like smoke right in the big heart of SFU where everyone's kind of walking by. So doing events like those can be really effective outreach. Movie nights are forms of outreach as well. There are ways that our chapters engage their local communities and get folks interested and involved who might not necessarily want to spend their time being involved with CSSDP, but would like to learn more about drugs and drug reform and harm reduction, those kind of things.
What are maybe two or three of the key reforms that CSSDP has pushed for in recent years?
One of the big things I think with CSSTP from my experience being on the board so far, big push in decriminalization. I think that's the basic level when it comes to work in this field. Because I think with decriminalization and legalization, I guess it gives space for a lot of better like rehabilitation and support of people who are using drugs.
Yeah, decriminalization has been a staple of CSSTP's policy position and one that we've been trying to push forward over the past couple of years. Also, a lot of our work is centered around actually getting youth to the table in order to talk about substances as well. Independently, some of our members have worked on the local decrim campaigns. Kira, our chair, for example, has worked on getting Montreal to support decriminalization. I think those have been our main focuses as a national organization, as well as things like getting access to drug checking and drug checking services for people who use drugs. Safe supply is, I think, one of the things that a lot of drug policy organizations push for. And for folks that don't know, safe supply is basically giving people who use drugs access to regulated drugs through the medical system rather than having them have to buy them off the street. But I wouldn't say that's been a CSSDP policy push itself recently.
Tell me more about why decriminalization of drugs is so important and what you've done to push for it.
Decriminalization means a lot of different things. I will give the definition that I think is the only really workable one. So currently in our drug policies, you have a charge that is possession, and then what schedule the substance you have in your possession is. determines the maximum penalty that you're able to get from being in possession of that substance. And so decriminalization is basically making it so that the possession of a drug is not in and of itself a crime. Selling drugs, that's still illegal, and that's a different, broader question than the current decriminalization movement. At its heart, decriminalization is taking away a strategy from the police and from the criminal justice system to put people who use drugs in prison or in other coercive circumstances, which I would include mandatory treatment as a coercive circumstance. In terms of like what CSSDP has done, I think we've primarily just worked a lot with other organizations. We've partnered quite a bit with the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition. We helped edit a statement, I believe, by the HIV Legal AIDS Network around cities bringing in decriminalization of simple possession. I'm hoping that we will be able to do some sort of campaign that will be around decriminalization as a national board sometime in the near future. But we haven't really had the opportunity yet to really lead on a project like that. And COVID-19 is also one of the big barriers that's made that a bit challenging.
In more of like a general sense, I think CSSDP, when we're talking about decriminalization, one of the biggest things I think we've done as a grassroots organization is spreading knowledge. Because I think when it comes to discussions like decrim and advocating for decriminalization, you have to share this education, this knowledge about what it means. Because I feel like a lot of students, you know, when I first moved here, my knowledge around this was very patchy. And I think CSSDP provides this great resource for people to understand what decriminalization means. Because I think with movements like this and advocating for decriminalization of drugs on a personal level, you have to understand what it means. When it comes to conversations like this, it's always quite a taboo subject to bring up with your friends. Well, my friends are back home anyway. I feel like to understand decriminalization, from how I learned, was to understand what plays into drug use. There's so many reasons, you know, you can't ever summarize that. But I think once you understand what drug use is, what it means to people, it's a lot easier to transition into the argument of decriminalization. Going straight into that without breaking it down and helping people understand the root causes or some of the root causes of why people use drugs, it's hard to convince them to see why decriminalization is a really great option. People blame individual reasons for why people use drugs, and it makes it very difficult to transition into the decriminalization topic.
I feel like whenever you're having a conversation with someone and it's on a topic where there's a lot of background stigma or discrimination that's associated with that topic, you have to try and find a point where you can kind of agree first. And how I would talk to that person would depend on where we actually do agree. It's really like finding that common ground with someone and seeing like where the tension actually is, and then kind of talking it through with them. Just to add one bit to that, maybe the challenge to this question is that I think CSSDP for the past couple of years has been trying to get its feet back on the ground. For organizations, it can be really challenging. Like, we don't have any staff members. It's all volunteer board members for the most part. We do have the Get Sensible people who are working just on the Get Sensible project. We have staff in that sense, but otherwise it's an entirely volunteer run organization. And so right now we're just in a moment where we have the capacity to be able to lead on projects like this and maybe do something even more than around decriminalization. I think our best stories are yet to be told, as it were.
Most often when I hear about activism and organizing challenging unjust drug laws, a lot of it is quite directly tied to street.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to an episode of Talking Radical Radio with Scott Nine. If you would like to listen to the remainder of this episode, you can check out talkingradical.ca/radio. That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like to support the show, considering making a donation during our annual funding drive, which occurs from March 18th to 28th. The easiest way to make a donation is online at ckut.ca/donate. Be sure to mention The Avalanche in your pledge. If you'd like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalancheckut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Jose, that's up next.